WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keys. There is joy on both sides of the Israel-Hamas war as hostages were exchanged and were reunited with loved ones. CBS News correspondent Chris Lipsey has the latest.
The men today appear to be in better health, not visibly emaciated like the three hostages who came out last weekend, but as for doctors in Israel to determine. Sagi Dekohen comes home to his wife and three little girls, including one he's meeting for the very first time. She was born just 2 months after he was kidnapped.
There's some severe weather on tap for this long holiday weekend. CBS News meteorologist Andrew Kosak.
The atmospheric river once again is going to be pushing more Pacific moisture, slamming across the West Coast as we head into Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. 3 to 6 inches of rain this time for Northern California, the coast of Oregon, and then over towards Seattle, up toward Washington.
The Department of Justice has formally moved to drop corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams after prosecutors said he was needed to help the Trump administration carry out its immigration policy. CBS's Willie James Inman at the White House.
At least seven DOJ officials have resigned in protest. The internal shakeup at the DOJ comes as the Trump administration is moving swiftly to reshape and downsize the federal government. Several federal agencies have started to lay off hundreds of employees who are under a probationary period.
A measles outbreak in West Texas is spreading fast, and it's up to nearly 50 people now. This as vaccination rates fall in at least 10 states around the nation, raising worries about preventable diseases running rampant. Dr. Linda Yancey in Houston.
This is extremely concerning because it is so contagious. If those vaccination rates start to fall as they have been, we have the potential to become a measles endemic country again. We are backsliding.
Bad news for tennis fans. CBS's Stacey Lynn.
Italy's Jannik Sinner has been banned from tennis for 3 months after failing two drug tests last year. The 23-year-old who won the Australian Open last month said it wasn't his fault that trace amounts of an over-the-counter spray were found in his doping sample. He said he didn't use it. It was his trainer who had applied it to his own skin and then massaged Sinner.
There is a memorial service in Savannah for Sam Lilly.
Our hearts are broken because we weren't ready for Sam to leave yet. His assignment on Earth ended way too soon.
He was the American Airlines pilot who died in that mid-air collision between the passenger jet and an Army helicopter last month. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Conservation groups are criticizing the Trump administration's new review of all oil, gas, and mining on public lands. Suzanne Potter reports.
New U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has ordered a 15-day internal review of these sites, which conservation groups warn could be a first step toward altering their boundaries to allow fossil fuel and mineral extraction. And yet, Daniel Hart with the National Parks Conservation Association says this would do little to address the energy emergency recently declared by President Donald Trump.
The timeline from starting a lease sale until oil and gas is pumping and then refined and into the markets is a long time. It would not immediately do anything to lower gas prices.
In the past, Carrizo Plain National Monument on the Central Coast has been eyed for oil and gas development. Other national monuments in California whose boundaries could be reevaluated include the two newest, Chuckwalla and Satitla National Monuments, along with 13 others across the state. Hart says these public lands are crucial for wildlife habitat and recreation, and he points out they pump billions of dollars into the outdoor economy.
They protect both natural and cultural resources. They are a great place for our shared histories, but also the public benefit. They support the outdoor recreation economy, especially in rural states.
Across the U.S., 24 million acres of public land are already leased to oil and gas companies for fossil fuel extraction, with over 12 million acres under active drilling. The NPCA says key monuments that risk losing protections include Devil's Tower in Wyoming and the Dinosaur and Hovensweep National Monuments in Utah. I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A cloudy sky with scattered flurries for today and a high in the upper 20s. Couple of snow showers tonight, mostly cloudy and colder, a low near 5, and a high only near 10 Sunday, early flurries then clearing. Much colder for the work week next week. It's 24 right now.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee film critic Matt Miller, and Northeast Wisconsin hip-hop artist and musician Matt Harper joins me in studio. We're going to light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey there, political orphans, swing voters, independents, that whole gang. Welcome to special edition of Lost in the Middle. We're going to do a countdown between the middle of September and work our way up till Election Day. And we've sort of switched out the format. This won't be storytelling the way we do things. But instead, what I'm doing is talking to some of the smartest political podcast hosts in the country. But before we go there, I want to tell you a quick story. When I left Congress, it was sort of running up to the 2000 election. And I got a call from a good friend of mine named Brady Williamson. And Brady said, I've got an idea for you. What's that? He said, let's try to get a political debate in Madison, because it would be interesting in the 2000 election. And Brady had worked for the Clintons for years and was a Democratic operative. And I said, let's rock and roll. So we reached out to what was then called the Political Debate Commission, which everybody thought was an official arm of the federal government. But instead, it was just a cozy room between a longstanding Republican and a longstanding Democratic operative who figured out a way to make money on this. And the deal was you had to raise $500,000 because the presidential debate is a television operation. And so the first thing we had to do was raise, I don't know, I think it was $200,000 to show that we were serious, which actually was much easier than we thought it would be. We had a couple of large Madison businesses step forward, and then some foundations locally, and then we were ready to rock and roll. And then out come the folks who actually scout the presidential debate. And so we wandered around Madison looking for venues. And so the whole Madison community was geeked about the idea. And then they wanted to show off the new Madison Civic Center, which had been designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And they walked in the room, and we probably spent maybe 3.5 minutes in it, because if you've ever seen anything designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, it may be brilliant, but it's weird. And every section we looked, there was a column or a weird thing. Walked out of that, then went to the old Oscar Mayer Theater. Yes, Madison was the home of Oscar Mayer Wieners and the Wienermobile. And they liked that a lot, but it was a really cool old building and would have great angles to look down on the audience and look very ornate and very rich. And then it turned out by the time they built out the stage downstairs, there'd be no time for sitting. So that went out the window. And so we ended up with the Madison Expo Center, which was just basically a big box. So it was a weird year because the Olympics were that fall and the World Series was really late. And so they decided at the end of the day, they're going to have to do all of the four debates, three presidential and one vice presidential, in a very compressed time frame. So we're sitting around like the NFL draft waiting for the phone to ring. And they pick up the phone and say, Brady, Scott, we've got some great news for you. Okay, we want you to host the vice presidential debate. It's like, who the hell watches the vice presidential debate, much less trying to raise $500,000 to stage it? And as we're looking through sort of depressed glasses at one another, they say, here's the date. And they pick a weekend in October in a great Wisconsin story that's not a punchline. It was the World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin. We were off the hook. You could not find a hotel room because people with trailers and pickup trucks were driving their prize Holsteins to Dane County, Wisconsin to show them off. So our prize for doing that was actually we got tickets to go to the presidential debate in Boston. Al Gore and George Bush.
The highlight of the night for me personally was that Christie Brinkley sat in front of me with purple, sort of eggplant-colored leather pants. And let's just say it was not a particularly good look. But the defining moment of the debate was Al Gore doing this every time George Bush started to answer a question. And it's literally graded by historians as one of the 10 worst debate moments in U.S. presidential history. So we never ended up with the debate here, but we just all watched the debate. And I want to turn around to my guest, Andrew Heaton, who's actually calling us in from Scotland, from a phone booth in a men's businessman club, I take it is, Andrew?
I'm at the Royal Scots Club, which is just a nice, stuffy club that has allowed me to become a member. I like to work out of here, and being a humble boy from Oklahoma, I find it endlessly funny to talk to old British men in three-piece suits. So I come to Scotland to avoid the Texan weather for about a month a year, and then I work out of here.
Well, you can tell by the early introduction. So Andrew actually hosts a podcast much aligned with us called The Political Orphanage. So that means my political orphans actually live in his political orphanage when they turn into his podcast, which is terrific. Mm-hmm. He's been a stand-up comedian. He's performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. He's written a bunch of books, including one that's called Laughter is Better Than Communism. And he actually opened up for William Shatner, who said, wow, that Andrew guy, he's pretty funny. But the cool thing is, most people won't know this, and I actually know this because my youngest son spent some time in comedy, is you performed with Upright Citizens Brigade in L.A., which is sort of the West Coast version of Second City, who don't know it. So,
yeah, it was New York, but yes, the UCB, it had outposts on both coasts, and I got improvisational training from the good people at UCB. I have a certificate saying I'm funny. I have it on my wall. UCB is a fish. I'm licensed to be funny by UCB.
That's terrific. And then worked on the Hill for Tim Holden, who's an old buddy of mine, who was a Democrat from Pittsburgh. We used to play in the congressional baseball game together. And Tim actually had one of the worst moments I've ever seen because he and Bill Jefferson, another Democrat from Louisiana, who later on got sentenced to prison for racketeering, but that's an entirely different story. Tim was at first base. Bill was at catcher. Somebody popped up in the middle of the first base and home plate, and they collided head on. And Steve Largent was playing with us, former NFL football player, who said that was the ugliest collision I've ever seen, worse than anything I'd ever seen in the NFL. And they both, Tim got gashes, Jefferson got teeth knocked out, everything in the world. So now that I've completely wasted everybody's time for 8 or 9 minutes with a story that went nowhere, let's talk about your impressions of the debate. Does it really matter? Did it really change anybody's mind?
Yes, I think they do. So I was very skeptical of the debates up until about 3 months ago. I'm one of these people that is angry at the what had been the Presidential Commission on Debates, because it seemed to me that they were intentionally icing out any third party candidates that would come in, and I was ruffled about that. I was angry that Gary Johnson had approached whatever metric they needed, and then they immediately put it up to 10% in order to ice him out, and was taking the rather cynical view of like, look, everyone in America has made up their mind about Biden and Trump. This is, you know, before Biden dropped out. No one needs any additional information. It's not as if Trump is some sort of coy, opaque figure that we don't know a lot about. And I have changed my tune on that completely. I watched the debate between Biden and Trump, and I had been likewise kind of skeptical about the whole Biden mental acuity thing, because that sounded to me like kind of a made up Republican talking point. And then I, like much of the rest of the country, watched the president's brains drain out of his ears like motor oil and went, this apparently they were right about this. We have been gaslit, America. So I thought that the debate did a really good public service at that point. The most recent, so for that reason, I think the debates are good, just because they do allow you to see if somebody's truly crazy or not. I don't think that they're particularly salient for policy discussions, and the latest debate was not salient for policy discussions, but I think that they could be useful in that regard. In terms of pushing people to vote in a particular direction, yes. My understanding is that last-minute voters tend to be disproportionately affected by the personalities they see on display at the debates, and by bombardments of advertising that get them the last couple of weeks. So for most people that are plugged into politics, and I would imagine that that's the bulk of your audience, they probably have their own internal compass that they're using and some kind of metric they're using to make decisions in terms of who they're going to vote for that involves ideology and policy goals and character or something to that effect, right? I think there is a group of people, and they're ultimately who's going to determine this election, which are not nearly that attuned to politics. And so for them, they're running a lot of this off of gut feelings and vibes. And in that capacity, I think it's going to really benefit Kamala Harris, because my personal suspicion is I'm telling all the Scots while I'm here, I'm putting it 60-40 on Kamala Trump. I think she's going to take it. It's going to be razor thin, but I think that she's probably going to take it. And my rationale for this is that I think the last minute voters, they're not reliably Republican or Democrat, are going to basically go, I don't know, I associate Trump with old screamy guys. I don't like that. Let's give this new lady a try. She seems sane. And Kamala did a good job of appearing sane and reasonably normal for the course of the debate. And so I think that that vibe will work to her advantage.
So who's left that hasn't made up their mind?
I think it is the swing, like the truly swing voters, right? So like I'm an independent, and I'm a big critic of the two-party system, and I will kind of join people in breathlessly talking about how wonderful it is that independents are gaining traction and they're now the largest voting bloc. They're larger than Republicans or Democrats. But when you really look at it, the majority of independents, probably about 80%, are reliably Republican or Democratic voters, but they just really don't like the party. And so it's almost like a protest that they're registering as an independent, but they're going to vote Republican or Democrat. That leaves about 20%. And half of those people, I think, are like me, where we are very plugged in, but we have our own aberrant, weird Rorschach test that we're applying to American politics, which means we're not permanently in the pocket of either camp. But I think that there's another group of people that for them, they're living their lives and they're thinking about work and thinking about their kids. And they're not really thinking about politics. And so they're a lot more affected by how they would judge a used car salesman, which is like, does this person seem honest? Does this person seem like they're going to be the person who's going to sell me the right car? Are they going to swindle me? Can they get things done? Are they going to be a good boss? They're going with personality attributes to a great extent. And I think those are the kind of swing voters that will be swayed by the debate.
I think for folks who are political junkies, it's hard to understand. I mean, I keep running into people who say there can't be any undecided voters. They can't be, but there are. And I think people have a hard time comprehending that. And, you know, the interesting thing is if you talk to political consultants, I mean, I spent a bunch of time arguing with Mike Murphy over this idea, whether they're independents or really they're just closet Republicans or closet Democrats. If you talk to the folks at Arizona State and Tom Riley, who runs the only political science department in the country, which has a specific study of independent voters, he'll tell you there are a significant chunk. And if you look, you can see it for yourself. If you look at the vote totals in 2012, they went dramatically for Obama. Then they turned around and shifted to Trump. And then in 20, they shifted around and voted for Clinton. So I do think there's a group that is permanently disengaged with either of the major political parties. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Andrew, I want to talk to you about why I think your analysis is wrong on the debate, because I want to tell you the two issues that I think are trouble for Harris.
Great.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
Pat Kreitlow, all your time in the media, television, radio, what have you, what was one or two of the oddest things that people were complaining about?
As a TV anchor, your hair.
You have some of the finest hair around. How could anybody criticize your hair?
Oh, well, because a consultant forced me to change it.
Were there focus groups?
I'm not aware of any focus groups other than the audience, which universally hated it. It was a bowl haircut.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Dom Salvia Show.
Dr. Susan Webb Yackey, what advice would you give everyone who has an opportunity to engage in conversation with folks, and sometimes we don't think alike?
One state of mind is to be curious about it. How did you come to that point of view? And the other is humility. This idea that we don't have all the answers.
I know.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Well, welcome back, and we're just beginning our conversation with Andrew Heaton, who's a great political podcast host on a podcast called The Political Orphanage. He's done a lot of comedy work. He's written a whole bunch, and he and I think share a lot of sort of similar framing of how we think this election goes. So if
I'll even add to that, Scott. You were kind enough to come on my program, The Political Orphanage, and you think so similar to me that it kind of freaked me out. And at one point, I began postulating that you might be me from the future who'd come back to talk to me in the past. It was very unnerving.
Well, we can probably sell that as a pilot to CBS or somebody.
Yeah, I like that. Time traveling pundits. Yeah.
So there's sort of two framing things you have to do in elections. Well, there's actually three. I mean, if you and I are running against each other, I have to define you. Right. And then I have to define who I am. And then the third thing is you have to figure out what issues you're running on. And sometimes that's good for you and sometimes it's bad for you. And I think the problem for Harris is going to be as we get closer to those undecided voters, it's people who weren't thrilled with what the economy's looked like the last 4 years. And I think I'm not a fan of the former president, as anybody who listens to this show knows. But I just think at the end of the day, it's people who are still worried about the cost of gas, the cost of bread, about taking their kids to McDonald's, about canceling a summer vacation. I think those folks are going to look and say, wow, Trump's really a strange guy, but it was better than he was president.
That could be the case. I mean, I think one of the other things that Kamala is doing that is a strategic decision that may or may not benefit her is she's intentionally trying to remain a kind of Schrodinger's candidate, where when she ran in 2020, as Trump has pointed out multiple times, she ran as a very progressive candidate and then flamed out before Iowa. Whereas now she has tacked much more to the center and is emphatically in favor of fracking and all of the things that more centrist Democrats would favor. When I was at the Democratic National Convention last month, it was lots of really good vibes. Everybody was really happy. The AOC wing of the party was really happy with her. They were thrilled with Tim Walz. The Obama free trade wing of the party liked her. Everybody liked her. And so she had a kind of internal rationale not to cease being a quantum candidate and really define herself because she'd alienate one wing or the other. And she's kind of started doing that because she's released some policy papers, so you can now actually get a feel for what she's allegedly going to do. But I think she's kind of playing that same card at the general election. And I do think it'll help in terms of the people that are just going off of vibes because they're just going to see a fresh face and go, I don't know, let's try a new one. In terms of the economy, you might have a point there. The polls indicate that people associate Trump with a better economy. I have a lot of qualms with that in that I am very much in favor of free trade and think tariffs are stupid. So I have a lot of problems with his economic model. But that seems to be earned or unearned the benefit that he gets. He gets like a +5 in economy.
Yeah, which is interesting. And then the other issue, which isn't hot for her either, is immigration. And so that's why I think she did a marvelous job in the debate making the case for the case against the Republicans on abortion, which I thought was really the high moment of the campaign. And now let's talk about the low moment of the campaign. People eating pets and casseroles in Ohio, which seems, I appreciate the fact that CBS fact checked it, but did you really need to fact check that?
That, all right, there's two ways we can look at American politics going forward. We can either be very sad or we can find it very funny. I've decided to find it very funny. I have decided to treat this more like a sitcom than a Black Mirror episode. And looking at it with the sitcom analysis, I thought that whole moment was very funny because the precipitating moment to that was Kamala obviously baiting Donald Trump in a way that you could see from a million miles away, where I don't remember what the actual thing they were discussing was. Probably it wasn't the border. It was something else, the economy. I don't know. And she went, I invite people to watch a Trump rally. Because what you will find is that people leave early because they find it boring and exhausting. And I saw that and I was like, there's no, like any other political candidate would go, well, that's just, you know, like that's not really pertinent to what we're discussing here. But Trump could not, like, no, in a million years, Trump cannot let that go. So he immediately had to come back with, like, our rallies are amazing. And then after that, he was so addled, that's when he stepped into the they're eating cats line. And yes, I think the weird analysis that I have been seeing of the debate is where a lot of the pro-Trump people are saying, you know, the moderators were fact-checking Trump much harder than Kamala Harris. And I'm like, yes, I agree on that. However, the whole they shouldn't have fact-checked him as hard on immigrants are eating cats line, to me, is just not a really good strategy. I'm saying, like, if only they hadn't fact-checked him on that, he'd be doing okay. I don't think so.
But the flip side of that, and I thought CBS really, or excuse me, ABC did a pretty good job and tried to balance it. And I think the mics being muted, while it didn't make for as much street theater, at least you got to hear what people were saying rather than, it's my turn to talk. But I was troubled by the fact they asked one question about her policy flips. She answered it on fracking without pushing her, and then they never went back to the other stuff, which I thought let her off far too easy. And that bothers me. I mean, I generally, as somebody who spent 14 years in journalism, still spend a lots of time on the journalism board at Northwestern University. I find a lot of the coverage, unfortunately, skewed. Do you agree with me on that?
Wholeheartedly, yes. I know you played board games when you were in high school, Scott. Did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons by chance?
I wasn't that weird. I played Risk and games in a couple
of times. Nice. I was a big Risk guy. In D&D, you've got character attributes, and you'll roll your character attributes of how strong you are and how smart you are. And in American politics, Republicans just kind of get a +5 automatically on the economy, and they get a +5 on defense. And Democrats just get like a +10 on integrity from the media. Like they just, you by virtue of being a Democrat, you automatically get kind of a soft glove there. I didn't think that the moderators were in the can for Kamala, but I agree. I think generally speaking that the people that are running those debates are probably trying to be even-handed, but they're personally very invested in Trump losing. And as a result, they're overzealous in fact-checking him. And I think that goes back to, like, Romney and Obama. I don't disagree with that. I think that the media scrutiny is a lot harder. It's arguably one of the benefits of Trump, because I'm also not a Trump guy, but one of the benefits of Trump is that I think he actually compels journalists to do their job. When Biden, like, I as a, like, turn-your-head-and-squint-level journalist, like, I could technically be a journalist depending on how you're looking at me. I view myself as in a positive adversarial relationship with politicians, the same way that a prosecutor is in a positive adversarial relationship with a defense attorney. There's an emergent order that comes out of the system by virtue of both parties squaring off against each other. So I don't want to take the position of just liking people in power from one side and disliking the other. I think we should always be putting pressure on them. And when Biden won the last election, the fact checker for CNN just went on vacation. And I looked at that and was like, but this is the exact time that you should be fact checking the incoming guy when he's like, this is the time to really. But the attitude was the threat is over. The threat is over. We can all go home now. And yes, I think that becomes a big problem with legacy media.
Well, and I think there's a big problem with legacy media, too, in terms of diversity. Right. You saw the big kerfuffle when one of the NPR editors quit, because when he did a check of where his fellow reporters were registered, you can do that at the political rolls in Virginia and Washington and Maryland, because it's all a public record. There were no Republicans. It was 93-0. And famously, you know, in the study that was done by Nate Silver, it was only 6% of journalists self-identified as Republicans. So Not that they're making things up, but it would help if they had a little different perspective and didn't think the world would be solved by five more government programs.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Up North News Radio.
CBS News Brief. That hostage exchange between Israel and Hamas brought joy to families of those held by both sides and hope to other families still waiting for relatives to be freed. The BBC's Debbie Russ.
The latest round of hostage and prisoner releases by Israel and Hamas has been completed after days of concern that the Gaza ceasefire deal was close to collapse.
A measles outbreak in West Texas has nearly doubled in the past week to 48 cases. Vaccination rates have fallen there and in at least five other states. KHOU-TV's Stephen Gowen.
Vaccine exemption requests in Texas have more than doubled from almost 46,000 in 2018 to 93,000 in 2024.
More firings by the Trump administration. CBS's Christian Benavides.
Nearly 1,300 employees at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about one-tenth of that agency's workforce. The Department of Health and Human Services is bracing for cuts.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Brandon Woodruff back on the mound. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. At Brewers Spring Training in Arizona, pitcher Brandon Woodruff throwing 20 pitches for the first time to batters after having surgery on his shoulder back in October of 2023. How did it feel?
Felt great. When you can kind of break down, obviously I was nervous, jittery. It's the first time in a year and a half, but I felt good. I think it went a lot better than I expected to, which was I needed this. I needed to face hitters. I needed Bowers, and I needed William to step in the box. You know what I mean? Like, you got a all-star steps in the box, the first hitter you've seen in a year and a half. I mean, you can't help but get a little adrenaline going. So it was good for me. Got some good feedback, and now it's just recover. Like, go recover and get used to doing this again.
NBA All-Star Weekend, the Bucks' Marcus Johnson named a finalist for the Basketball Hall of Fame. The final vote to be announced in April. Bucks head coach Doc Rivers did not make the cut. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A cloudy sky with scattered flurries for today and a high in the upper 20s. Couple of snow showers tonight, mostly cloudy and colder, a low near 5, and a high only near 10 Sunday, early flurries then clearing. Much colder for the work week next week. It's 24 right now.
Earl Ingram.
Mayor Johnson, we used to have a saying called a switcheroo. Talking about one thing while behind the scenes, there's a greater issue.
This man was elected president of the United States to focus in on making everyday life more affordable. But our push to remove lead service lines, our health department, are impacted by the things that the Trump administration have targeted since they've been in office. Yeah, it's been a huge switcheroo. It's not been about saving folks money. I mean, this is going to cause more pain.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Every story matters, and the Civic Media Radio Network is celebrating Black History Month by honoring the powerful stories of Wisconsin's own trailblazers. Meet Rob Dees, the Madison artist and educator, adds his own twist to Black History Month.
For me, it's always a responsibility to be Black History every day. I appreciate the month, and I'm going to celebrate it to the fullest, but it's also an importance there to be Black History every day.
Rob lives what he says, too. One example, mentoring troubled kids who embrace their own stories and share through the power of hip-hop music.
Trying to get kids to really understand their story is important, their struggle is important. I've often heard the word inspiration associated with what I do, but like, my biggest hope of inspiration is to inspire others. And I feel like these babies are the future, so we gotta inspire them.
Rob is lifting up the next generation while still honoring the past. Listen for more inspiring stories all month long. I'm Terry Barr.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually a really good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that.
You'll get 50%.
It's live in the Lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
I'm Charlie Behrens. This is Civic Media, and here's my conversation with Lawrence Pratt.
And so anything that's floating gets carried towards the center. But it doesn't actually collect right in the very center. I mean, it will collect in a pretty big region. I mean, something that's about twice the size of Texas.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so you find larger concentrations of floating plastic and microplastics at the surface of those gyres. Charlie, it's not though like you would go out in a boat there and you just see something that looks like a garbage dump.
Right, right.
There might be places where you see floating bottles and so on, but it's not like it's not like this awful place. It's just more if you actually measure what's out there, you count the number of plastics, you just find greater concentrations there than you do in other parts of the open ocean.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah. A lot of the microplastic in the ocean is going toward these gyres in the various oceans. That's right. On the surface.
Yeah.
What about under the surface?
Yeah, that's a big mystery. So we know that there's, a lot of the heavier plastics, they just sink to the bottom and they get into the sediment, and that's been well measured. Even in the deepest trenches in the ocean, you can find microplastics in the sediment. But there's some plastics that they have a density that's fairly close to seawater. And so they might be just slightly buoyant or, just a little bit heavier than the water. And so they can be suspended for long periods of time in the ocean. And those are the ones that I'm interested in. But when you actually go out and look for them, you can find very, very small numbers, and then you can go to another spot where you find really large numbers. So for example, one survey that I saw took a bunch of water samples at like, I'll say 1,000 meters depth, and they hardly found any microplastics. But then I talked to another team from Japan, and they took some samples from underneath the Kuroshio, which is a big current there. And at about the same depth, they were finding like 1,000 particles for every cubic meter. So we just have samples here and there, very sparse samples. And so we really don't know a lot about the subsurface distributions of microplastics, but we do know that there are certain places where you find a lot of them.
And we should step back and say that how did these microplastics get into the ocean to begin with? Like, what is a microplastic? Where does it come from? And what can people who are interested in just stopping their part in creating more microplastics, what can they do?
Yeah, so a lot of microplastics, first of all, microplastics are small bits of plastic, kind of the largest size that we think of as a microplastic is 5 millimeters. Okay, so a millimeter is what it's about the size of the thickness of your toenail, something like that. So the larger ones we can see, they range in size all the way down to to a micron, which is like 1/1000th of a millimeter. So those are ones we can't see, and then you have ones that are even smaller than that. Those are the nanoplastics that you talk about. Those are hard to find. We don't know too much about those. And where do they come from? There's a lot of different sources. So they can come from the disintegration of things like plastic bottles and plastic bags. You think about a bag that blows into a stream or something like that, and then it travels down that stream. It's subject to mechanical stresses from the water and the waves. It's being hit by ultraviolet sunlight. And so it can slowly break up into small pieces. Or you can take, like a plastic container. I went to the hardware store the other day, and I was looking at tools, and I saw there were some wrenches there they came in these plastic containers.
Dude, nothing pisses me off more when you have a pipe wrench wrapped in plastic. You know, like, it's a pipe wrench. I think it's going to be fine.
You know? And then you take it home and you try to, you know, you try to cut into it with your scissors and it's, you know, it's hard and brittle. And even when you're cutting into it, you can, you're creating a lot of little tiny plastic shards. Those are microplastics.
That's amazing to me. The crap people wrap in plastic. Like I got some knives, like a knife block, and every single knife, they individually wrap like the handle in plastic. I get if you wrap the blade, you want to protect it with some, but I don't know. I feel like cardboard would be a lot easier than the plastic, but just the amount of unnecessary plastic stuff that you order, like you get a shirt and it's in a plastic bag. Why? You know, I don't know. I'm on my soapbox now, but I'm glad you brought that up at the hardware store. Of all things, I don't need wrapped in plastic. It's a friggin' wrench, you know?
Yeah, right. And then there's fabrics. There's, you know, like fleece jackets, you know, and I'm as guilty as anyone at wearing those fleece jackets. They're, you know, they're comfortable. They're great. But they do shed a lot of little microplastic fibers when you put them in the washing machine. And that stuff, you know, it's gonna make it into your municipal wastewater treatment plant, and you know, some of it will get filtered out probably, and some won't, and so it'll end up in a stream and eventually into the ocean.
That's really interesting. I don't think a lot of people know that. So what kind of clothes would have microplastics in them, and are some clothes worse at shedding microplastics than others?
Yeah, so the plastic is the PET you probably heard of, which is a type of polyethylene. And so these kind of sweaters or, you know, zip down jackets, a lot are made from that. It's polyester. And if you look closely at it, you can see that there's a lot of tiny little fibers there, and that's basically a type of plastic.
That's on all kinds of, like is spandex, there's a lot of plastic in the clothes, but do some come off more in the wash? Like if you wash them cold or something, does that help? Is it the heat that releases them, or just they just release all the time?
Yeah, I think it's probably just the mechanical stress of being in a washing machine being turned around that turns them loose. There was one of the companies that makes these, to their credit, did some experiments where they put one of these things in a washing machine for 24 hours. The reasoning being that that's about the time that an average jacket is going to spend in a washing machine over its lifetime. You know, maybe you wash it once a year or something like that for 12 years. Mm-hmm. So they did that, and then they counted the number of microfibers that got shed from that jacket, and it was in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So just don't wash your clothes.
Well, that's, yeah. And then, you know, you probably have to be careful of how to dispose of them, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you can't, they're just a problem anywhere they are. How do you dispose of them? Do you have any ideas on that?
We have, every once in a while in our town, you know, there's a collection of certain types of plastics that you can't just put in our regular recycle. Like, you know, recently there was a styrofoam. You could go to the high school and leave your styrofoam stuff there. And there's also collections like that specifically for fabrics too. So you could, you know, you can be on the lookout for those. If you're wherever you live, if they do that, you could take advantage.
Very interesting. Yeah. I mean, you know, you do as much as you personally can. It's probably not going to stop this is real tragedy of the commons. Like, yeah, maybe I can be looking out for that styrofoam recycling or that fleece jacket recycling. But when most people don't even know that that's what's happening with fleece jackets, you know, you can see real quick. Like, what role do you think sort of the companies that are making those things should have in, like, telling people about that and also kind of cleaning up what has been put out in the environment?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to get too down on the companies. I think it might have been Patagonia that did this experiment. And so that's to their credit, you know. And I think these companies are right now, given the interest, you know, of the health risks of microplastics, are probably thinking about developing new fabrics, maybe fabrics that don't actually shed the microplastics or are based on some other material. But, you know, in general, I think we can do a lot just with trying to avoid single-use plastics, you know.
Oh, like plastic straws?
Plastic straws, plastic cups, those styrofoam plastic cups that, you know, you go down, you know, if you're working in an office, you go down to the coffee machine and they have those styrofoam plastic cups. Typically, those things just get thrown away after one use.
Yeah.
Plastic bags, you know, you can reuse plastic bags many, many times.
So eliminate the single-use plastics. That's really good. What about, is there any way to kind of filter out, like, let's say with the washing machine, you know, and you know the way kind of water works and, you know, can the filter go in the washing machine since it's hard to filter once it's in the ocean? You have to worry about all those other things. But is there a filter that you could put in the washing machine itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I have no idea.
You ever think about like inventing one of those things or like how would you even go about doing it? You know, or is that not really in your specialty?
That's not my wheelhouse. But, you know, if there's a lot of inventors out there, you know, I could see developing something like that. And then maybe, you know, you take it on Shark Tank and get some funding for it.
There you go. Yeah. Mark Cuban, you know, throw $1 million for 500% of the company and then sold. You know, what is it in your studying of the microplastics and nanoplastics in the water system? What are you really like? What's kind of your holy grail? What are you really hoping to figure out? What gets you really excited about it?
So I would like to be able to tell people where in the ocean, the whole three-dimensional ocean, where microplastics are collecting.
Because once you know where they're collecting, then you can go get them, I guess.
That's right, yeah. And I'd also like to be able to tell people where the plastics are actually going. That's part of the story, too. So, you know, the estimates of microplastics that are getting into the ocean every year are something like 5 million tons to 12 million tons. So just lots of plastics. But when you go out and you measure or you estimate how much of that stuff is floating at the surface, it's a very small percentage of that. So where is the rest going?
Mm.
And so, you know, there's kind of a budget there. We'd like to figure out, you know, how much is going in, how much is staying in, how much is going, where is it going, how much is washing up on beaches, how much is going into the sediment. Of the stuff that's going into sediment, you know, is it possible that any of that can get resuspended? You know, questions like that.
It's kind of with the ocean being so big, it's how deep is the deepest part of the ocean? Do we know?
So the deepest part is about 10 kilometers, which is about 35,000 feet.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Man.
And they found microplastics down there. So that's in the Challenger Trench, I believe. And so some of those really deep trenches in the Western Pacific, they found microplastics at the bottom of those trenches.
So we know they're getting all the way down there, huh?
Yeah.
It can sink. That's crazy. Yeah. What do you think about people who say there's aliens in the ocean? You think we got any motherships down there?
Well, if you can show me some evidence, I'll consider it. I haven't seen any evidence yet.
Okay. I'm just throwing everything at you, just seeing what we can do here.
Yeah.
What is the weirdest thing you've ever found about the ocean?
The weirdest thing, I'm not sure it's the weirdest thing, but the thing that really kind of got my attention is that about half of the oxygen that we breathe actually comes from the ocean.
Really?
Yes.
And how do we get that from the ocean?
So the ocean at the surface has phytoplankton, which are these small organisms that use photosynthesis. And so they're using carbon and they're releasing oxygen just like trees.
Oh, wow.
And as it turns out, quite a bit of oxygen.
Holy smokes. Yeah, I didn't know that either. That's crazy.
Yeah.
How much impact is climate change having on our oceans right now?
Well, so our oceans, our oceans actually absorb a fair amount of the CO2 that we're pumping into the atmosphere. I'm going to say something around 30%. And that's because carbon dioxide can dissolve in water. And then, you know, that carbon that gets in to the ocean gets used, you know, as part of what we call the carbon cycle. So there's organisms that use it. And sometimes those, and so it becomes part of the food chain. And then those organisms will, you know, they'll die or they'll poop it out and it'll sink down to the bottom and become part of the sediment. So a lot of the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere actually gets into the ocean. And, but the other thing is that actually makes the ocean more acidic.
And then that's when you get when you see those coral bleachings. And so then the coral gets bleached. So like this all is, it's kind of very complicated. It's really not that complicated, but for your average person who's just scrolling on their phone all day, what are like the big things that you think like you should care about this? Why? So the ocean takes in all, it becomes more acidic. The coral reefs get bleached. We hear that happens, but then what does that mean for your average person?
Yeah. So, for your average person that loves coral reefs, that's a big red flag, right? Because a lot of the coral reefs have been bleached. You know, you look at the Great Barrier Reef and that's been bleached. And that's also, you know, a function of the water getting warmer too, which is another consequence of atmospheric warming. And then of course when the water gets more acidic, it makes it harder for shellfish to grow shells. And so, you know, it impacts, you know, the food that we get from the ocean.
So basically it like messes the whole food system up, because like if shellfish have less hard shells, then I mean that not only impacts our enjoyment of those fish, but it also probably makes that species more susceptible. Couldn't that collapse the whole food chain of the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of taking me out of my realm, but yeah, that's what, you know, in general, that's what people are worried about. Another thing that people could think about is, you know, the effects of sea level rise. And about half of sea level rise is actually just due to the thermal expansion of the ocean. So the water gets warmer and it expands a little bit. That causes sea level to rise. And so there's places in the Pacific that are being lost, you know, beautiful coral atolls that are probably going to be lost within the next 50 years. There's an island nation called Kiribati in the Pacific, which includes Christmas Island and about 30 other atolls. And, you know, the highest elevations of these places are maybe 6, 8, 10 feet above sea level. And so they can't really tolerate much sea level rise. And I've been to these places. I love to go bone fishing. So I've been fishing for bonefish on Christmas Island a bunch of times. And now I kind of have to face the prospect that it might not, you know, might not even be there, you know, by the end of the century. And it's just an incredibly beautiful place. It's got palm trees, you know, and beautiful flats and lots of marine life. And so those places are going away. The government of Kiribati has even purchased land on Fiji, which is more mountainous island, and you know they're planning for the you know the populations on those islands to eventually move there.
Wow, yeah, that's and then the Maldives, that's another one, right? Where yeah, these are like the modern day Atlantises. And well, then so they are already planning on relocating their people because of sea level rise. What about like Florida? You know, you always see the hurricanes picking up intensity. You see more flooding. What does that have to do with climate change and increased ocean temperature?
Yeah, well, of course, the hurricanes kind of feed on heat that they get from the oceans. And so as the oceans warm, you know, the hurricanes could potentially get more powerful. And they cannot, and it's complicated too. I mean, they might get started at higher latitude than they do now. The hydrological cycle increases as the planet warms, so there's more rainfall, more evaporation, more water cycling through the atmosphere. And so, you know, the expectations is that the hurricanes are going to get stronger. I'm not sure about the numbers. I don't know if the number of hurricanes is going to increase or not. And then you combine that with, you know, with slow sea level rise. And so that's going to impact a lot of coastal areas in places like Florida, or, you know, places like Bangladesh, where there's a lot of people living at, you know, very close to sea level.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the sort of the microplastics of it all, is there something about microplastics that sort of they're sort of toxin sponges, kind of like they absorb toxins? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. And we have a group here at Woods Hole that works on that. So when, you know, when plastics are manufactured, there's a lot of additives that can be introduced, you know, and it might make the plastic softer or harder, or give it some color, or make it more resistant to UV rays. And there's a huge variety of additives, something like 10,000 that can go into plastics. And about a third of those are associated with some sort of health concern too. So if a plastic, so right from the manufacturing point, you know, there are additives that could potentially leach out, like if the plastic got into the tissue of a fish or something like that, it might make its way out. But as you say, there's also some evidence that plastics can kind of attract toxins that are already in the environment. And then the same thing can happen. And, you know, that plastic gets ingested by an organism, a fish or something like that. And then that might be harmful to the fish. But I think, you know, we're kind of scratching the surface of these health risks right now. Some of the studies are very worrisome, but there's a lot of research that we still need to do.
Right. But at the end of the day, there's so much plastic in the ocean essentially right now that it's in all of our water, and therefore it's in the air as well. And it's gotten into our bloodstream. It's gotten into our brains have plastic in them. It's in all of our bodies. And is there anything people can do can they put a water filter in? Is there something they can do for their individual water intake to help in the near term while, you know, hopefully science catches up with getting these microplastics out of the water system?
Yeah, so I don't know what's out there in terms of water filters. You know, certainly the filters that are in everyday use are going to filter out the larger microplastics. But the really small ones, which are the ones we know less about and the ones we kind of worry the most about, might not get filtered out. So, you know, are there developments in industry right now to try to to make filters that can get out the very smallest ones? I'm not sure. That's a good question. But yeah, the best thing to do is to get them right at the source, right? Mm-hmm. Not wait till they're in your river or end up in your ocean where it's really hard to filter them out.
Yeah, and the source, I mean, it's a very small percentage of plastic that actually ends up getting recycled. You know, you see the sort of recycling label on a plastic bottle. I think only 3% of plastic in the United States.
Well, that's all the time we have for now. But if you want to listen to my full Cripescast, check out the Cripescast anywhere you get your podcasts.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend's headlines and give a preview to the spring primary election on Tuesday. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
As of 9 a.m. this morning, our EV trucking company is officially in operation.
Andrew's zero-emission trucks are driving the transportation category forward.
We'll make driving safer, easier, and less stressful.
Now our technology needs to keep up with demand.
He needs to put pedal to the metal on hiring more software engineers.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you sponsor a job on Indeed, it's easier for talented candidates to find it, which makes it easier for you to hire them. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. Health professionals around the nation are concerned over a measles outbreak in West Texas, where cases have doubled in the past week to 48. This is vaccination rates there, and in at least five other states are dropping. KHOU-TV Stephen Goen reports.
Dr. Linda Yancey with Memorial Hermann says,
unfortunately, since the pandemic, our vaccination rates have been going down all over the country, but especially here in Texas.
In the state's largest school district, Houston ISD, the vaccination rate amongst kindergarten students fell from 94.7% to 78.7% in 2020. It's now climbed back up to 93.5%.
The Trump administration is penalizing schools over some vaccine requirements. CBS's Christian Benavides.
President Trump is back in Florida this weekend after signing a series of executive orders from the Oval Office, including one that